Well, I gather you've been working your way through Hebrews chapter 11, which is a great passage, and it's not just an opportunity to think through various ways that the challenge of faith applies to life, but it's also a great way of surveying the story of the Old Testament, starting right at the beginning and then working through to the point, which you'll reach in a few weeks' time, where you discover that the writer to the Hebrews more or less says, look, time would fail me if I was to tell you about all of the other characters. That's what happens with a look at all of these people. But it takes us through that survey of Old Testament history. And what you notice is that really, along with Abraham, the person who gets the greatest amount of mention, the most number of verses in Hebrews chapter 11, is Moses. Between verse 23 and verse 29, there are actually five incidents that are mentioned in relation to the life of Moses and in relation to faith. Now, the first of those is the one that I think you looked at last week under the heading of the faith of courageous women. And that's in verse 23, where we're told that by faith Moses was hidden by his parents, born at a time when, time of genocide really, when instructions were given for all the firstborn Hebrews to be destroyed, born at a time like that, and by faith his parents decided that they would trust God rather than obeying the king. You then have four other incidents that occur during his life and that are described as being by faith. By faith he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. In other words, he renounced his status. By faith, he left Egypt. By faith, he kept the Passover. And then when you come to the last mention of faith in relation to Moses, it's actually slightly different, because it doesn't say by faith Moses did something, but it says in verse 29, by faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as if on dry land. But they did it, obviously, under his leadership, and he was part of them. So it was part of Moses' journey by faith. And it's those four things that we want to look at this morning: renouncing his status, leaving Egypt, keeping the Passover, and then leading the people on dry land through the Red Sea. Those are the four things that we want to look at. First of all, by faith Moses renounced his status. He refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, you've got that in verse 24. Now, many of you are aware of how the story evolved. As Johnny said last week, you left him bobbing around among the bulrushes in the little boat that his parents had made for him. And somehow they were just trusting that God would take care of him. And as many of you realize, what then happened was one day the daughter of Pharaoh is by the river, and she discovers this baby. And she thinks, well, goodness, this must be one of the Hebrew babies. What will we do with him? Moses' sister Miriam is watching, and she pops up with a very bright idea. And she says, well, listen, what I can propose is I'll find a nurse, one of the Hebrew women, who'll be very happy to look after him for the next few years of his life. And she goes off and finds Moses' own mother. And you actually get a great sense, almost of God's sense of humor, how amazing God's plan is in all of this. God had undermined Pharaoh. Pharaoh's plan, Pharaoh's idea was, if he could get rid of the male children — the boys were the problem, the men were the problem — if he could get rid of the men, he could gradually do away with the problem of the Hebrews. And God used three women: Moses' sister, Pharaoh's own daughter, and Moses' mother, in order to preserve Moses, and Moses eventually became the downfall of Pharaoh. So he grew up in the royal family, if you will, and we know from Stephen's message that he preached in Acts chapter 7 that he was given a really good education, grew into a powerful and gifted man. And we know that by the time he was 40, he was a man of great privilege and great standing, grandson of the most powerful man in Egypt. But when he reached 40, he made a decision that was going to change the rest of his life. What happened in terms of the story And again, many of you are aware of this, is that one day he was taking a walk and he saw something happening. He saw that there was an Egyptian who was mistreating one of the Hebrews. And Moses decided that his moment had come. Moses had the potential to be a very angry man. You see it in several instances in his life. And Moses, something welled up inside him, a sense of anger at the injustice that was happening, and he made the decision that he would intervene on behalf of his Hebrew brother. He killed the Egyptian. Next thing that happened was that there were two Hebrews who were fighting. And Moses thought, well, I'll go and sort them out as well. And he went over and said, come on, guys. You know, why are you fighting? Two Hebrews. I mean, we're here. This is Egypt. The Egyptians cause us enough problems. Why would you be fighting among yourselves? And they said, well, who do you think you are? And we know what happened earlier in the week. We know what you did to that Egyptian. And as soon as Moses realized what had happened, that the information had been leaked out, he had to run. Now, you could get into all kinds of questions of whether Moses was right to kill the Egyptian or not. Was it the right thing in the wrong way at the wrong time? You can get into all of those questions. We don't have time to debate them in detail. But what we need to notice is this. When Moses made the decision that he would kill the Egyptian and stand up for the Hebrew, he was making a decision that from that time on, his future belonged with the people of Israel. His future belonged with the Hebrews. He decided that he would no longer be an Egyptian. He refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And that was a momentous decision that he made. And if you glance down at verses 25 and 26, you notice that there were two parts to the decision. There were things that he weighed up. It says, first of all, that he chose to be mistreated rather than to enjoy pleasure. And then it says that he considered that the reproach of Christ was greater than the riches of Egypt. Now, those things don't really make sense, at least for most people, probably for most people living in the modern world. Those reasons for doing what he was going to do don't really make any sense. If Moses had decided that he wasn't going to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter because a better plan had come along, somebody had a better idea that was going to be more comfortable, that was going to be more successful. If someone had offered him that and he said, well, okay, I'll give up Egypt because you're offering me something that's obviously better, well, we would understand. But what Hebrews says to us is that the choice that he made no longer to be an Egyptian was a choice to be mistreated, to suffer reproach along with the people of God, rather than to enjoy pleasure. And it was a choice that he would take the reproach of Christ and consider that that was greater than the wealth and the riches of Egypt. Now that is strange. That is really strange behavior. Okay, strange noises, strange decisions. I hope you see that. That'll remind you, you know. A memorable point. If you forget anything, he said there was a strange thing happened. And the strange thing was that he was talking about something strange in the story of Moses when the strange thing happened. And anyway, hopefully that pedagogical device will work. Thanks for remembering to do that at the right time. But think about it. Why would you turn down pleasure and enjoyment when the alternative is to be mistreated? Why would you turn away from the kind of wealth that most people would only dream about and would never hope to get anywhere near? Why would you turn away from that when the alternative was actually to be mistreated with a bunch of slaves? That's the calculation that Moses made, and that's the decision that he made. Somehow, he realized that the pleasures that were there, well, yes, they were pleasures, but Hebrews describes them as the pleasures of sin. Doesn't go into a lot of detail about it, but we know that somehow what was available to Moses would have been a lot of fun while it lasted, but it was going to lead him further away from God, and he didn't want that. And we also know, because the pleasures are described as fleeting or temporary, that none of it was going to last. And Moses was able to perceive that even though there was tremendous wealth in Egypt, that somehow the future lay with the people of God. And somehow there was a reward that lay with the people of God that was far greater than those riches. And even though it was going to mean suffering, and it was going to mean shame, and it was going to mean rejection, and it was going to mean a certain amount of disgrace and reproach, Moses decided it was worth it. Now think about what that must have sounded like to the first readers of this letter. In all probability, this letter was written, we don't know who wrote it, but the letter was probably written to people who had become Christians, or become followers of Jesus, out of a Jewish background. They'd believed that Jesus was the Messiah. He was the promised one from the Old Testament. They'd put their faith in him. And it had led to them being rejected. Some of them had their property confiscated. There was persecution. There was suffering that came along with that. All because they had decided to identify themselves with Jesus Christ. And as they're reading this, they say, well, the same thing happened to Moses. By faith, Moses made a decision that he would say no to where he had come from. He would say yes to something very different. By faith he did that, and he chose reproach rather than the riches of Egypt. Now faith can do that. Faith can lead us to a place where we have to decide who we really are and what direction our lives are going to go in. Faith can lead us to a place where we need to decide what direction our lives are going to go in. Now, some of you are older. You've made many of the major decisions of your life, and you're now living the results of those decisions, some of them good, some of them you may have regrets. Some of you are younger, and God willing, much of your life is ahead of you. And I'll say again, there are times when faith leads you to make a decision about the direction that you're heading in and the identity that is going to be built as to who you are. Faith is going to lead you to a place like that, and there's decisions that are going to have to be made. And I know that we don't like to be negative. It's not kind of cool to be negative. We don't like to talk about what the followers of Jesus are against and what the followers of Jesus don't do. Yet at the same time, there are times when faith leads us to say no to certain things. Sometimes deciding who you are means deciding who you are not. For Moses, he decided that he was not an Egyptian, because he was one of the people of God, and that is where his future lay. And decisions like that are not always easy. Reproach. Generally speaking, we don't like people to look down on us. We don't like people to call us bigots or old-fashioned or stupid. We like to be accepted, especially when we're younger. We certainly don't like to think that some people might think that we're weird. Being accepted, being popular, is much more appealing to us than being rejected, than, to use the words from Hebrews, bearing reproach or carrying a certain amount of disgrace. Now, I'm not going to try to turn this message into a Daily Mail style moan about everything that's wrong with Britain, but you know as well as I do that there are areas of life and there are areas of thought where views that Christians have held, and a generation ago, nobody would have even thought to question them. There are views that are held that increasingly are viewed as bigoted or stupid or dark views from a past era. Is it still acceptable to believe that God created the universe? Now, I don't want to get into the details of the Giant's Causeway and the exhibition and 6 days and 24 hours and 6,000 years. I don't want to get into any of that. But is it still acceptable to say that God created the universe? Or to say that, does that bring about a certain amount of reproach? Is it still acceptable to believe or express a belief
that marriage is an institution that brings a man and a woman together. There's some places where nowadays to say a thing like that is regarded as hate speech,
pushed out onto the fringes. Is it still reasonable, as Christians have believed, that Jesus Christ is the only way to God? That his sacrifice is the only means by which people can come to God? Is it still acceptable to say that? Or is that a narrow-minded, bigoted thing to say? You see, there's some very real issues that are already with us and that may very well multiply in the next few years, where some of us are going to have to decide who we are. Some of us are going to have to decide our identity. We're going to have to decide where we stand. And it may mean accepting the reproach of Christ. Why did Moses make his choice? Well, it says in the text that he was considering the reward. He had his eye on the reward. He knew that this was going to be worth it in the end. It's like Jesus. Later on, in Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 12, just more or less at the end of this great section on faith, the writer talks about Jesus, how that he went on and endured the shame and the pain of the cross. Why did he do it? Hebrews says he did it for the joy that was set before him. He knew that there was something ahead of him. Think about Paul. In another part of the New Testament, 2 Corinthians, he talked about light momentary affliction. And he said that it was preparing an eternal weight of glory that was beyond all comparison. Now, if you know much about the way Paul suffered, and you know much about the things that people did to Paul in an attempt to oppose him and discourage him from what he was doing, that the struggles and the pains and the difficulties that he had in his ministry of following Jesus, well, to call it light and momentary affliction, for most of us, I don't think we would use those words. Many of us would struggle to cope with a fraction of what Paul had to cope with. But yet he had this view that somehow there was going to be a future, and it was going to have a weight of glory to it. There was going to be a reward, and in comparison with where he was going, what he was being asked to give up was really not very much. Do you remember Jim Elliot? Some of you remember Jim Elliot. Some of you are too young. You maybe have just about heard of him. One of five young American missionaries who was killed by a hostile tribe in Ecuador in 1956. And one of the most famous quotes of Jim Elliot's journal, something that he wrote in 1949, 7 years before his martyrdom, was this. He said, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." That's what Moses did. He gave what he could not keep and what would not last in order to gain what he would never lose, even though it meant choosing suffering and mistreatment and reproach. Sometimes that is the place that faith leads us to. Second thing, Moses left Egypt. Look at verse 27. "By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible." Now, that looks like a fairly straightforward verse. Then you start to think about it a little bit, because you say, well, by faith Moses left Egypt. Right. But he left Egypt twice, didn't he? He left Egypt the first time when he had to escape, because the secret of having killed the Egyptian was known to other people, and he was worried that Pharaoh was going to find out, so he had to escape. That was the first time he left. And then he left a second time, didn't he? Because he came back and went to Pharaoh, and there were the plagues that we've seen graphically and vividly illustrated on the wall here. There were all of those plagues, and then he left Egypt again, and he brought the Israelites with him. And you think, well, he must be talking in verse 27 about the first time he left Egypt, because by faith he decided he wouldn't be the son of Pharaoh's daughter. By faith he left Egypt. And then by faith he kept the Passover. Well, the Passover is the third event. If you just go in terms of the chronology, he decides he's not going to be an Egyptian. He leaves Egypt because he's got to run away. And then he celebrates the Passover, and then he leads the Hebrews out of Egypt. So it must be the first time that he left Egypt. And then you think, well, that's not quite right, because it says that he left Egypt not being afraid of the anger of the king. And that would be very odd to say that about the first time he left Egypt, because the first time he left Egypt, he was afraid of the anger of the king. He was afraid that the king was going to come and there would be payback time for what he had done. I'm inclined to think, and commentators will debate this and come up with various ways of looking at it, but I'm inclined to think that when there's this reference here to leaving Egypt, even though it's mentioned before the Passover, the reference is to the second time he left Egypt. The big time when he left Egypt and he brought all of those people with him, packed up the whole nation of the Israelites, and they left. And at that point, he did not fear the king. In fact, he had stood nose to nose with the king, and he had challenged the king. He'd said to him repeatedly, "You are to obey the Lord of heaven, and you are to let these people go." And the king said, "No, I won't." And then the plagues came, and so on and so on. Moses was, once he got there, he was fairly fearless. He did not fear the king. And so I think that's what verse 27 is referring to. This challenge where he challenges the Pharaoh and then leads the people out of the nation, out of the land of Egypt. He did it and he didn't fear the king. Now you notice why he didn't fear the king. It says in the passage, it says that he did not fear the anger of the king. For, in the second part of verse 27, he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Now this may be a reference to the experience that Moses had when the bush had caught fire. It may not necessarily be that. But what Hebrews is saying is that Moses had such a sense of who God was, it didn't really matter who Pharaoh was. He wasn't afraid of the king, because he knew who God was. He endured because he had a vision of the invisible God. Let me ask you an odd question. Are you afraid of people? Now have a look around you. Are you afraid of anybody here? Oh, I don't necessarily mean that, you know, there's somebody and they're going to beat you up sort of on the back, on the side of the church, you know, on the way around to the car park at the end or something like that. Or even that someone's going to yell at you, or you know, something like that. But are you afraid of people? It's actually a more complex question in a way than we sometimes think. There's a book that was written a number of years ago by a Christian counselor called N. Welsh, and the book is called "When People Are Big and God Is Small," and it's a book about being afraid of people. Now, N. Welsh suggests that actually, being afraid of other people pops up in all kinds of ways in our lives. If you're a teenager, have you ever heard the expression peer pressure? Well, it's being afraid of other people, isn't it? It doesn't mean that you're afraid they're going to beat you up or going to yell at you, but it means that you want to be able to fit in and you're scared of what might happen if you don't fit in. There's a pressure to conform. There's a pressure to be like your peers because you want to be accepted by your peers. If they don't accept you, well, you sort of feel that life's not going to be a terribly happy place. You're afraid of losing their acceptance. You're afraid of people. You get a little bit older, you don't call it peer pressure, you call it being a people pleaser. Which is always, your life revolves around always trying to make sure that everybody's happy. Always saying no to what maybe you would really like to do because you want to make sure that everybody else is happy around you. This is a tricky one because sometimes it masquerades as Christian servanthood. And Christian servanthood is a good thing. When we serve other people out of a sense of devotion to God and out of a sense of loving those other people and really wanting to do them good, that's a good thing. But there's sometimes, quite honestly, when some of us are just afraid to say no. We want to please people. Is that not being afraid of people in the same way? And sometimes the way it manifests itself is just a sort of desperate hunger for approval. It affects preachers, you know. We stand up here in front of you all and we preach. And then we're done, and then we go to the door, and we've got to stand there. It's sort of like the opposite of running the gauntlet, because the gauntlet runs past you. But you stand there, and the gauntlet runs past you, and people shake hands. And should think, because I hope somebody says something positive. Because we want approval. We want to have that sense of, I'm okay, I'm accepted. People approve of me. And if people don't approve of me, well, what on earth is going to happen? How on earth am I going to survive, never mind thrive in my life? And these are actually ways in which we demonstrate that we are afraid of other people. Not afraid of Pharaoh, but we're afraid of our peers. And could it be that actually the answer to those kind of fears is the same answer that Moses discovered? Why was Moses not afraid of Pharaoh? He endured, he was able to go through what he went through, this challenge that he gave to Pharaoh, and eventually leading the people out of Egypt. He was able to do that because he knew there was an invisible God who was greater than Pharaoh. And there's an invisible God who's greater than anybody that you know, whose approval is far more important than the approval of anybody that you know, who is greater than your peers, who is greater than the person who intimidates you. There's an invisible God. And if we learn to see Him and know that He has accepted us, then what other people think actually doesn't matter quite so much, does it? Thirdly, Moses kept the Passover, verse 28. By faith he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. Now this question of leaving Egypt that's been raised in verse 27, it took a while. There were the plagues because Pharaoh was very, very stubborn. And eventually, because of the defiance and the stubbornness of Pharaoh, the plagues gave way to this awful final plague, which was the death of the firstborn. An awful plague that was unleashed on the nation of Egypt. And the Passover feast was the meal that Israel kept on the night of that final plague. It was a meal that would give them strength that they were going to need for their journey out of Egypt. But also, within the context of that meal, there was a lot of symbolism. And chief among the symbolism was the sprinkled blood. They were to take the lamb, they were to kill it, they were to sprinkle its blood around the frames of the doors. And God said, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Hence we have the name Passover. But what exactly does that mean? When I see the blood, I will pass over you. Now, some of you may have had an experience in your career where there's been promotion on offer in your line of work. And you've been hoping it's going to be you. And all of your friends are saying, yeah, you need to apply for this new job, this promotion, because obviously you're the best person for it. And the time comes, you don't get it. It goes to somebody else. And you might say, well, I was passed over for promotion. In other words, they skipped me out and went on to somebody else. And it could be that that's what Passover means in the story of Exodus. God says there's going to be judgment that's going to come through Egypt, and it'll come onto the Egyptian houses. But when I see the blood, I will pass over you. I will skip you out. Could mean that. But I think it means something actually a little different. I think what it means is that as God would bring judgment across Egypt, and you know there's a you notice there's a reference to the destroyer, a destroying angel. As God's agent of judgment was traveling through Egypt and bringing death into the various Egyptian homes, God would see the blood and He would hover over the homes where the blood was on display. Now the reason I think that that's what's happening is because of a verse in Isaiah chapter 31. It's a chapter that talks about trusting God for protection. And it says, like birds hovering overhead, the Lord Almighty will shield Jerusalem. He will shield it and deliver it. He will pass over it and He will rescue it. And that's what happened, not just in Isaiah's time and his prophecy, but that's what happened in Exodus. The Lord hovering over a house where the blood was on the doorposts, hovering over it in order to protect it. God sheltering people from his own judgment. That's what happened in Exodus. God sheltered people from his own judgment. And you know enough, don't you, that that is not the only place in the story of the Bible where God sheltered people from his own judgment. That's what was happening when Jesus died on the cross, isn't it? God was providing a way that you and I could be sheltered from the judgment that we deserve. All of us have sinned. All of us have fallen short of God's glory. And yet there is a sheltering place because Jesus died. The Passover lamb. Our Passover lamb. Not a literal little sheep, but Jesus is the fulfillment of that sacrifice. And that's the place where we find shelter. And Moses' response to the announcement of Passover, by faith Moses kept the Passover, is actually a way that we need to respond to the gospel. I think one of the things that's implied is that Moses obviously reckoned that God was serious about this judgment. He obviously, it was something that was going to have to be taken seriously. If Moses hadn't believed that God was serious about judgment, he wouldn't have needed to keep the Passover. But by sprinkling blood, he showed that not only did he take the warning seriously, but he also had total confidence in the means of salvation that God was providing. You can imagine some of the Israelites would be saying, well, we've seen these plagues, locusts, blood in the river, frogs. We've seen all these kind of things. And you tell us that the firstborn are going to die? The Egyptian firstborn are going to die? And if our firstborn want to be saved, we've got to sprinkle blood and put blood on the doorpost. How is blood on the doorposts going to actually do anything to protect our sons? Moses said, that's the way that God has said. You need to do it. By faith, Moses kept the Passover. It's funny, isn't it? I think that sometimes people don't take the warnings necessarily very seriously. People could have said, oh, Moses, don't be ridiculous. A thing like that's not going to happen. Can't really happen. A few weeks ago, Pauline and I were at the graduation ceremony of Belfast Bible College. And as is customary in these kind of gatherings, thankfully we don't seem to have to do it in church services just yet. But in these kind of large gatherings, it's a bit like EasyJet. You know, they stand up on an EasyJet flight and they tell you, oh, here's the exits and there they are, you know, over the wings and up the front, down the back. And, you know, if anything happens, make sure you put your own life jacket on before you help someone. Have you ever thought about that? Why would you put your own life jacket on? It's a very interesting thought, isn't it? Because if you don't put your life jacket on, well, it's not... Anyway, that's a digression. But they give you these kind of warnings. No life jackets at the Bible College graduation. But they've got to do this, you know, in the event of an alarm sounding, you know, and I can't remember what they said, probably about escape routes and all of that kind of stuff. And the ironic thing was that no sooner had the person who was making the announcement made the announcement, I think she then went out to open in prayer, and while she was opening in prayer, guess what happened? An alarm went off. Guess what happened? Nobody moved. Apart from two people. Two of the staff of the college got up from where they were sitting at the back, and they went out because they probably assumed there's something wrong with the alarm, we'll have to go and get it to shut up. But it happens, doesn't it? I remember it happened two or three times in Port Stewart Baptist as well, in services where the alarm would go off, and everybody just sort of sit there. Nobody really took it seriously. By faith, Moses kept the Passover. He took God seriously about that warning. But more importantly, he trusted that what God had said would be the means of rescue, would indeed be the
the means of rescue. And the place that God said would be the place of shelter would indeed be the place of shelter. By faith, Moses kept the Passover. And we can say today that the blood of Jesus Christ, God's Son, cleanses us from all sin. Then he crossed the Red Sea, finally. Verse 29. By faith the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. So they got out of Egypt, survived the judgment, but, well, the Red Sea was a major obstacle. And for a time they're trapped. The sea's in front of them, and the armies of Pharaoh are behind them. What are they going to do? Well, option A is just to stay where they are, and the Egyptians will catch them and drag them back, and they'll end up being slaves again in Egypt. Option B is to drown in the sea. I suppose they could have decided to run off somewhere, and eventually they would die of starvation in the desert or something like that. No great options available to them. And they're standing there and they're crying out in despair. They're thinking, Moses, why did you bring us out? Why did you make us leave Egypt? Look at what you've brought us to. We can't go forward. We can't go back. We're just done for. And the first thing God says, or the first thing Moses says to them is, well, just stand where you are. Don't be afraid. Stand where you are, because you're going to see the salvation of God. I wonder, are there times when some of us just need to do that? Instead of scampering about frantically, trying to fix everything, fearful, stand where you are, let God work. But then God says to Moses, Moses, the time now for standing still is up. Step out. And they step out as Moses holds his rod out over the water, and the walls of water go up on either side. People walk right down the middle on dry land. Would you have gone through? If you'd been one of them, would you have gone through? You should have stepped out. This is bizarre. You step out and you see this wall of water. I think, is it going to hold? What if we get halfway through and whatever's holding it up stops holding it up and it all collapses in on us? Would you have gone through? Well, it says in Hebrews, by faith, they did. And one of the amazing things that is said about God in one of the Psalms is that God is able to open up a way where it doesn't even seem possible that there is a way. But once he does that, you need to go through it. By faith, they crossed the Red Sea. One final observation. Five incidents from the life of Moses to do with faith. By faith his parents hid him. By faith he renounced his Egyptian heritage. By faith he left Egypt. By faith he kept the Passover. And by faith, along with all those other people, he went through the water. The first one, although he's involved, it's actually got nothing to do with him in a way. He couldn't talk. Nobody said to him, oh son, what do you think we should do about this? I mean, it wasn't anything to do with him. It was the faith of his parents. And the fifth one, although he was involved in it, it actually says it was the faith of the people. By faith, those people went through. I think it's a very interesting progression, isn't it? Because what you see is that it starts out with Moses benefiting from the heritage of people whose faith helped to create a future for him. He survived because of the faith of his parents. And it ends with a whole bunch of other people who have followed Moses, and they've started to trust God too. Now, I know their journey's a bit patchy,
and lots of ups and downs. But they ended up following him in his faith. Starting off, benefiting from the heritage of people who had gone before him. Finishing up, leaving a heritage for people to follow him. Do you see what's going on here? Do you see how this might apply to us? Many of us, like me, many of us have that same kind of heritage. Parents of faith. Parents who loved God. Parents whose faith made decisions that we have benefited from. And we need to be grateful for that heritage. But we need to move on to a place where we're not always looking back, always grateful, but we need to look on and we need to say at a certain point, if you've been a Christian for a while, if you've been following Jesus for a while, you need to be looking around and saying, is there anybody else coming with me on this journey? Because there should be. It starts with that heritage and it ends up with something that is passed on to other people. That's maybe a little bit the challenge. Not keeping it to ourselves, but making sure we bring other people with us as we travel. So by faith, Moses was protected by the faith of his parents. By faith, he made a decision about his identity and his future, even though it meant paying a price. By faith, he was not afraid of the king of Egypt, but he led the people out because he saw an invisible God. By faith, he kept the Passover, trusted God and the means that God had provided for rescue. And by faith, the people that he had helped to lead went through in the way that God opened up.